Over the last month, I received an article by Rabbi Cardoza that we're going to consider now, and also there was an article which I'm not going to deal with today, but this was found in Makor Rishon, written by Elchanan Shiloh. And both of them deal, to some extent, about making, shall we say, adjustments to halacha. They're very different in tone, even though they tend to bring some similar sources, which itself is interesting. Elchanan Shiloh, who I'm not going to speak about today, he himself is an academic, and his logic is very, very simple, that we have a huge problem today. There's a religious community, there's a secular community, and there's nothing in between them. And there's a huge fight between. The only way we can achieve harmony and peace is by creating something new, which is in the middle. So therefore, he seriously suggests that we should open up a new kind of a shul that will have separate seating for those who like it, a men's section, a women's section, and a mixed section. Now, if he thinks this will bring peace, because all the secular people will start coming and all the ultra-Orthodox will start attending the same shul, so I cannot possibly imagine that a person can say this with any degree of seriousness. It seems to me that he had the whole agenda and article that he wanted to write, but he figured that, you know, it's a really good thing to say in the beginning and the end of the article that peace is so important and we need to get peace and harmony, because maybe then he'll get some kind of sympathy. But as I said, I can't take the body of the article seriously with the introduction and with the end. This will create a third way. It's not going to get rid of the other two ways. And it's just... there are shuls, that doesn't concern me. But the point is, there are shuls, there are people that do this, but that has not caused Mei Sharm to shut down all of their shuls. And this has not caused all of Tel Aviv to say, you know what, now I'm going to start going to shul. So my point is that it's a wonderful idea. Peace is a wonderful thing, but the rest of it is really difficult. But he's honest about one thing. His honesty is that he does say that halacha for him is really not important. What's important for him is the will of God. Now, how he knows what the will of God is and how he can decide that the will of God is outside of halacha, that itself takes some really fancy footwork. And if you like, we can come back and analyze this article as well. But what we're going to do instead is we're going to look at this article from Rabbi Cardoza. I spared you right now reading the whole thing. Those of you, and this will be, I guess, be the test, those of you who are intellectually honest and curious and want to read the entire article will send me an email, and I will send you the entire article beginning to end, and then you can read whatever it was, around 12 pages worth of this. The article has been published in a new journal from Rabbi Angel, and it's called The Future and the Spirit of Halacha. Subtitle, this is on page 3. You should start on page 3. Unconventional Thoughts in Relation to Autonomous Religiosity. And it's in a journal which is called Conversations. Issue 7, May 2010. By Nathan Lopez Cardoza. So here's the beginning. I turn these things into sound bites. And then we'll read for a little bit. And at some point I'll say, okay, we read enough and now I want to respond. I'm confronted daily with countless young Jews who search for an authentic Jewish religious way of life but are unable to find spiritual satisfaction in the prevalent halachic systems as practiced today in most ultra or modern Orthodox communities. For many of them, typical halachic life is not synonymous with genuine religiosity. So, point number one, he tells us that he is confronted all the time, he sees this all the time, which right away one has to ask oneself a question. Is this really a prevalent problem which exists within? Is this a prevalent problem? Or even more so, is this the prevalent problem? Or is this, you know, in statistics, you always have to make sure, in science, you have to make sure that you have not somehow been screwing the results. For example, could it be that these are the people that come to hear him speak? And that the people that come to hear him speak are the ones that have this particular issue, and I can be then, as I said, a little bit unfair, and could it be that the reason that they come to hear him speak is not because they have this issue, could it be because he has this issue? I mean, this is a man that recently wrote an article on why he thinks he should take off his kippah, and his only conclusion at the end why he shouldn't was because it would may confuse his grandchildren. Now, if grandchildren was a metaphor, and it wasn't, but if grandchildren was a metaphor for his students' students, that would be very interesting, but it wasn't. It was, I mean, basically he said that this has become meaningless and so on and so forth, and I don't have to get into that particular argument, but let's continue. He's claiming that the people that he sees, that there is this huge problem, that halacha, now he just made a real broad sweep of halacha. He just went from ultra to modern Orthodox communities. And I think, as all of you know, halacha is practiced somewhat differently. And I will give editorial comment, and I'll say, unfortunately, in some cases, between ultra and modern Orthodox communities. But he says, for many of them, typical halachic life is not synonymous with general religiosity. Well, what do you mean by halacha, and also what do you mean by halacha, and what do you mean by religiosity? Continue. Since they sincerely long for the opportunity to experience halacha. Now, right here, you know, if a doctor sees a patient and there's a problem, so you have symptoms, you have a diagnosis, and you have treatment. When a patient is by themselves, sometimes they notice symptoms, sometimes they don't notice symptoms. Sometimes they think the symptoms that they have, this symptom is really serious where it may not be at all, and then something else which they may not be paying attention to is a serious symptom. Which means, what exactly are the symptoms that he's seeing over here? What exactly is the diagnosis and what is the treatment? And I will be completely honest, I don't trust him in any of them. I don't trust the symptoms, I don't trust the diagnosis, and I certainly don't trust the treatment. But I'll and by the way, and here being careful and not being attacking. Me, I'm not being attacking at all. Just wanted to let you know. So let's continue. I've been teaching for more than 20 years. And I've been teaching some people that are religious, some people that are not religious. Some people that are not religious would like to become religious. Some people that are religious would like to become non-religious. I would assume that the bigger struggle is if you want to look at the entire Jewish world, the biggest problem is those who have no Jewish connection whatsoever. That's over 60%. Over 60% of Jews in the world never step foot in a synagogue. Way over 60% have never stepped foot in Israel. Way over 60% of the Jews in the world have no connection whatsoever. So if you really want to talk about what the real problem in the Jewish community is, it's the Jews that we have no connection with whatsoever. I mean, that's observation number one. If you want to look within the religious community, you have, on the one hand, a movement towards a Baal Tshuva lifestyle. Rabbi Weinberg once said to me, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, who founded Eshet Torah, he once said to me, there's no such thing as a Baal Tshuva movement. He said, it's a cottage industry. He said, it's not a real movement right now. It's something which is much, much smaller. But there is a movement of people that are secular, that are moving towards religiosity. There is a movement of people who were brought up in religious homes, who move towards non-observance. I mean, these are both major issues. How many people are out there that are within the non-observant, but the problem with being observant is because they don't find it really authentically religious? I mean, quite the opposite is true. Most of them may think that the only authentic religiosity is the most extreme religiosity, and therefore they think that that's too extreme for them, so therefore they can't do that. I think if a lot of non-religious would really see modern Orthodoxy as a possibility, they would find it much easier. And for that matter, a lot of the ultra-Orthodox who are raised that way, who can't take it anymore, move straight to non-observance because they think that modern Orthodoxy is something which is also not authentic. So you have a lot of people who go from this all-or-nothing perspective. That, again, is more of an issue than this. Are there people who are brought up within a religious lifestyle that do not connect religiously to religious practice? Absolutely. Absolutely, without doubt. But is it, again, since they sincerely long for the opportunity to experience halacha, that's just not true. Unless he has some kind of a definition of halacha. So I'm saying the diagnosis is one, oh, the symptoms that he's looking at, I just don't know what he's talking about. People... Some do.
Well, in this room, I bet everyone, you know, we live a certain way, whatever level that is, but it's a halakhic life. It's according to what we learned as Jews.
Right. Right, right. And there are certain things that we all do that sometimes when we do it without thinking, we do it by rote. And there's certain things that we do that when we do it, we find quite a connection with it. When you light Shabbos candles, do you just do that by rote, or you find that religiously meaningful? Okay, so therefore, it's not the problem that we need that you're finding the experience of halacha, which is not meaningful or spiritual. It could, again, I will admit that all religious people suffer from a problem that once you do something a lot, then you run the problem of doing it by rote. Okay, that is a problem. There's a problem every day for men to get up and put their tefillin on and to feel like the first time they put their tefillin on. Okay, that's a problem. Especially it's early in the morning and they're half asleep. Okay, I will admit that. But that doesn't mean that and I will also, I am sure that there are certain people that when they put them on have no idea what the meaning of it is. And I think that if they had more classes understanding what the meaning of it was, I think that then they would connect to the spiritual experience more. That practice without understanding is a part of the problem. If there's practice which is together with understanding, then it becomes that can often make it into that religious or spiritual experience. Look, I will admit something else. I once saw a rabbi, a friend of mine, give a class to a bunch of secular people. He asked them all, how many of you would like to become more spiritual? Every one of them raised their hand. How many of you, then he asked them a second question, how many of you like to become more religious? So none raised, maybe one raised their hand. So that was a very interesting thing, because for them, religiosity and spirituality were not synonymous. Now that is part of our problem in terms of PR. That means that we basically have failed. They think that religious people are not spiritual. That's what they think. They think it must be devoid. But it says something else. For a secular person, you say the word spiritual. The word spirituality will mean connecting to something beyond yourself. You know, beyond. When you say the word religious, then it's confining. And they find it's something which is choking and so on. I'm saying, those are the terms. Observant bothers people. Okay, observe. But I'm saying, but this is a question of terminology and words. And as I said, we've done really bad jobs in terms of PR. But if you would have asked that same group of people, how many of you would sincerely like to experience halacha? They say, what are you talking about? It's not a sincere. Again, if you took away the word halacha and what spirituality, then I would tend to agree. But it's not that they want halacha. It's not that they want limits or ways to lead their lives. And by the way, let's be very, very honest. The vast majority of people that I've met, and when I say vast majority, I'm not saying 61%, I'm not saying 91%, I'm not saying 95%. The vast majority of people that move from observance to non-observance, it is not because of philosophical questions, it is because of lifestyle issues. The issues of lifestyle which affect them or impact them, and not because there are lots, very often there are philosophical questions which they have as well. And the first thing that you have to ask yourself, and sometimes ask them, is this a question that you're asking me, or is this an excuse? Which means, do you want an answer to this question, or would you rather have the question because that's going to justify the decisions or the conclusions that you've already have drawn? And very, very often, very, very often, if they do have questions, they're not questions, they're excuses. Continue. The following observations are therefore not written from the perspective of a halachist, but from the perspective of a deeply concerned Jewish thinker who wants young people to be authentically religious while living a halachic life which is meaningful to them. That whole sentence, if it was one sentence, is absolutely meaningless. Excuse me? Because again, there must be some... You see, he admits that if you go over to a posek, and if you would analyze this in terms of Jewish law, that everything he's about to say is wrong. So now you can all ask me, so why am I wasting my time and going any further? But to say on the one hand, that I'm not writing this, he says, as a halachist, but as a Jewish thinker, as a philosopher, if you will. But it's because of young people want to be authentically religious while living halachic life. which now he'll qualify meaningful for them. So again, the diagnosis here I completely disagree with. I don't believe that there are thousands or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out there saying, I want to live a religious life and I want to live halachic life. Please allow me to do this. It's, as I said, it is coming from a very, very strange place. But as I said, there are certainly some people that are like this. I'm fully aware that the views expressed may... So let's continue. As I said, you have to interpret religion, you have to interpret halacha, you have to return, I mean, all these things, what exactly do the words mean? Yeah. Right. Okay. So let's I agree. So let's continue a little bit. I am fully aware that the views expressed may not be palatable to most bona fide respected poskim. Okay, so here he's telling us right away that what I'm going to suggest is not really within the realm of halacha. It is essential that the reader realizes my intention is not to simplify Judaism by making it more compatible with the progressive spirit of our age, nor do I seek to make Judaism easier and more user-friendly by finding leniencies and shortcuts. Okay, so that's very good. Judaism needs to be infused with greater spiritual vitality and religious vigor. Okay, I think that we can all agree with that as well. This is what so many young people are searching for today. I'd like to believe that's true also. There's also a lot of young people that are not searching for that, which is, again, I think that's the bigger problem, but okay. This may require application of agadic, non-legal, inspirational sentiments and halakhic decision-making. No doubt many foreign poskim will object to this approach. So what he's saying is, let me search for Judaism for some kind of a sentiment, and then I'm going to use that sentiment in application of halacha. So, and he knows himself that this is something which poskim will not necessarily go for, because halacha has its own approach, and agada has its own approach, and therefore they're not necessarily the same thing. What is the interrelationship between them, by the way, is a very interesting topic, maybe one which we'll come back to. Once additional spiritual dimensions are infused into the world of halacha, and the very image of halacha is seen in different light, and again, we have to know what the word halacha means in all this, young searching people will be able to find the Jewish religious life which they seek. So let's recreate Judaism in a way that young people will be able to find themselves finding spiritual meaning or religious meaning, and then we can call that halacha, and then they're following a halachic life. This may require going beyond the conventional klalei psika, which means against the normal way we decide Jewish law, which were used in the past. Over the last 500 years, famous rabbinic leaders have called to limit the overwhelming authority of Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch and Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. So here's where we begin to get interesting. Many famous rabbis, or some famous rabbis, he tells us, has called for the limit of the Shulchan Aruch and of the Mishneh Torah. Now, I will just give you a little bit of insight in this. Excuse me? Both of those, this statement is true, but it's only true immediately when those books were presented, or very shortly after those books were presented. So someone can say, you know, to the Rambam, you know, why are you writing a book like this? Or why you decide, who are you to decide what Jewish law is? And someone else can say to the Rav Yosef Karo, who are you to decide what Jewish law is? But you know what happened? It's very interesting. Both of those books became overwhelmingly accepted by very large portions of the Jewish world. So what is the, and this is also a very interesting topic, which also, B'li Neder, maybe we can come back to. Why does the Shulchan Aruch have the authority that it has? Which means, who decided that it has the authority? So there are a number of different approaches to this, and the easiest approach is, you know why it has authority? Because people accepted it. Now, you could tell me that's circular. But that, which means I can ask you, why was Rav Moshe Feinstein considered to be the Posek Hador? Who elected him? Were there ever democratic elections that decided that he was going to be a Posek who was accepted by people? What made him accepted by people? So what's the answer? People accepted him. So you say, but that's circular. Yes, that's circular. That in Jewish law, when people accept somebody as being the one who's going to decide Jewish law for them, so that person becomes the one who decides Jewish law for them. So, and again, you're going to tell me, yeah, but who decided this? So the answer is, the people decided this. So what is the authority of the Shulchan Aruch? So the best answer to that question is, the authority of the Shulchan Aruch is that people ended up accepting it as a book of law. Which means, who decided the Mishnah Berurah is going to be accepted book of Jewish law? So what's the answer? People who accepted the Mishnah Berurah. And that has happened throughout Jewish history. So it's true. So it's true. Right. So it's true. And that also becomes an interesting question. Once something is accepted, to what extent can something be unaccepted? But to make the statement, maybe. So we'll come to that. We'll come to that as well. But now, when he says that Rabbi Yosef Karo, that there are people who didn't accept it, yes, that's true. You can find people. What the Rambam did is, it's not just that he decided Jewish law. The main attack against the Rambam was that he didn't write any sources. Almost every other book that somebody wrote about Jewish law, I mean, if you think about the Rif, what did the Rif do? The Rif is an early decider of halacha. What did the Rif do? The Rif took the Gemara, went chapter by chapter, took out all the discussions, and left the bottom line. If you want to get, you know, when we were in high school, there were these books that you can read to get the cliff notes. You want to get the cliff notes of the Gemara, get the feeling of the Gemara, and get the bottom line without the whole discussion. That's what the Rif wrote. But if you want to know what the decision, it's very easy because the Rif is, you just go chapter by chapter in the Gemara, and he gives you he gives you the same language of the Gemara. So it's the exact language of the Gemara, but instead of the whole discussions in it, he'll say, "Oh, Rabbi Akiva said this, and that's the law." The Rambam never quotes Rabbi Akiva, or hardly ever will quote him. The Rambam will just write the law without telling you who it is that he's deciding according to. So the Rambam just wrote a whole new book and got rid of the whole discussions in it. But not only did he get rid of the discussions, he'd even tell you, alert you to what he was doing. Till that point, the other books that were written would take a passage from the Gemara and then tell you what the synopsis or what the bottom line or the conclusion of that was and therefore what the law is. The Rambam didn't even bother giving this. So people were upset with the Rambam for not giving any sources. Said, you should have at least footnoted your sources. By the way, what ended up happening because the Rambam didn't write his sources? There are more commentaries written on the Rambam than any other book other than Tanakh and the Gemara. Number three, in terms of Jewish literature, how many books have been written on it? Because everybody who was anybody wanted to say, I know what the Rambam got it from, but there is still a lively discussion where he got any particular law from. So to say that there was an attack, I just want to read that sentence again, because as I said, now it got interesting. Over the last 500 years, famous rabbinic leaders have called to limit the overwhelming authority of Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch and Rani's Mishnah Torah. That's basically true, that sentence. But as I said, the vast majority was immediately when those books were written. They felt these works do not reflect authentic Judaism and its halachic tradition. That already is getting a little is not exactly, in my opinion, accurate. And then he writes, the reason is obvious. Both these great codes of Jewish law are very un-Jewish in spirit. So it's not just that we don't like the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, they're un-Jewish. They present halacha in ways which oppose the heart and soul of the Talmud, and therefore of Judaism itself. They deprive Judaism, and this is a beautiful sentence, of its multifaceted halachic tradition and its inherent music. It is not the works themselves which are the problem, but the ideology which they represent, namely, the ethos of codifying and finalizing Jewish law. Now, I find this paragraph, excuse me? Right. So I agreed with him that he should take off his yarmulke. But he will consider himself to be Orthodox. He would consider himself to be an important voice within Orthodox Judaism. He writes in the beginning and the end of the article how he loves halacha, he loves Jewish tradition, and he's, you know, fiercely determined and so on and so forth. But a paragraph like this is... this paragraph is arrogant and simplistic. It's arrogant in the sense to say that I know what authentic Judaism is, and everyone else doesn't, including the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. They don't understand authentic Judaism, And we'll see some of the sources that he quotes to see how convincing they are.
This is close to the conservative movement.
Yes. I think even from Gateshead or something. It exposes elements of an artificial Judaism which has been rewritten in ways which detrimentally oppose its very nature. So again, he knows what the very nature of Judaism is, and all this. Now, it's interesting, the ethos of codifying and finalizing Jewish law. It could be that every single person who ever writes a halachic decision thinks that he's going to be finalizing Jewish law. It could be that every one of them thinks they're not necessarily finalizing, that they're writing what their opinion is. Whether it ends up being codified or finalized into something else. If he were here, he would applaud your explanation, and I think that you're right, and that's what his motivation is.
I know,
but let's get to the core. Is Judaism against the decision of halacha, or does Judaism, meaning, over here he's saying, what's the whole Gemara is full of arguments, right? The whole Gemara has many, many discussions. Is the purpose of the discussions to get to a conclusion, or is the purpose of the discussions to have discussions, which means... But again, answer. I like an answer to that question. Was the purpose of the discussions in the Gemara? Okay, A. The Gemara is full of discussions, full of arguments, full of different opinions. Is the purpose of the Gemara in order to have different opinions and arguments, or was the purpose of the arguments different opinions in order to try to figure out what the halacha is? What's the objective? What is the objective? The objective of every single Gemara is to figure out what the halacha is. That's the objective. The discussions are important, but again, what's the goal of the discussions? Fine. So the discussion. Right. Correct. So I'll say it again. What is the objective of the Gemara? The objective is not the discussions, though the discussions are very important. But the objective of the Gemara is ultimately to get to the conclusion. One second. The devil doesn't need an advocate. One second. Before we argue anymore, let's just read a little bit more, and then I'll take all of the arguments. It exposes elements of an artificial Judaism which has been rewritten in ways which are detrimentally opposed its very nature. Which means having a book of halacha saying this is what Jewish law is, he thinks is against Judaism, is artificial, is against the nature of Judaism. A careful read of modern Jewish Orthodox literature, it doesn't mean not modern Orthodox, it means modern Jewish Orthodox literature, reveals that many authors misunderstood the nature of Jewish law. Why do they misunderstand them? Much of this literature is dedicated to extreme and obsessive codification, which goes hand in hand with the desire to fix halacha once and for all. The laws of muksa, tefillah, kelim, tzniut, and many others are codified in much greater detail than ever before. These works have become the standard by which the young, growing, observant community lives its life. When studying them, one wonders whether our forefathers were ever really observant. So here we're getting very polemical. The observation is correct.
But it is correct.
In his 60s.
I went to Beis Yaakov, and I look at my nieces who live in Lakewood and went to Beis Yaakov. And you see how, I don't want to use the word deteriorated. I look at my yearbook of girls who went to Beis Yaakov, the way they were dressed, and the colors they wore, and I see no black, and I don't see skirts to the floor, and I don't see sleeves still here. So you do see that there has been an extreme. And this
correct.
Is
correct. 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 Now, there are many sociological factors involved in the way that people practice today. The observation that there are more and more books that are getting more and more detailed is a correct observation. Whether the objective of each of these books is to fix and codify Jewish law for all time itself is a debatable point. I want to tell you what I think is the biggest factor in this. I think you have a lot of people who need jobs and need to make some money, and therefore, I hate to say it, so therefore you write a book because you could do it. I think there's also a positive side to it. You have more people learning today than ever learning before, so I think it's a very positive thing if somebody's actually able to take one topic and research this. If somebody's been sitting in yeshiva for 15 years and he writes a book on every single thing about Tefillat Kelim or whatever other topic there is over here, I think there's something positive about that, and I think there's no different from in the academic community if somebody's sitting and doing research and eventually writing a doctorate. I think that's a wonderful thing. Now, again, the question's going to be, when this person publishes that book, do I necessarily have to say that everything in that book is correct and acceptable and so on? And it goes down to another point, which means there has been a difference between poskim and between people, let's say balabatim. And in between you have rabbis. Poskim are people who decide Jewish law. Rabbis are people who will then turn to poskim to decide Jewish law and sometimes decide some things on their own. Balabatim are people who want to do the right thing. When you have books like this, if I see like one of these books, The Laws of Tefillat Kelim, okay, I have a book at home, The Laws of Tefillat Kelim, I will look in the book. Certain things that he says I'll accept, certain things that he says I won't accept. If he was kind enough to give sources for things, I'll go back and look up the sources. If there's something which when I learned it, it struck me as being a little different from the way that he wrote it, just because he wrote it in a book doesn't mean that I'm not necessarily accepted. And that's me. I can absolutely assure you that a Rav Yashiv does not go looking into this kitzer, whatever it is, on Tfilas Kalim when somebody's going to ask him a question. And that's an extreme example. I can assure you that that what most poskim do today is they actually learn the material themselves, become proficient in all kinds of areas, and don't necessarily need these books in order to be able to decide. Are there going to be people who say, well, it says this in that book, and therefore that's what you have to do? Yes, there'll be people who are doing that. And that goes back to the discussion that we had in the very beginning when we started this discussion on halacha, which should we follow what our parents did or should we follow what it says in a book? And I told you right then, it makes a difference who your parents are and it makes a difference what book you're reading. And I'll keep on saying that. So now the fact that there are all these books and therefore that someone's going to write 300 pages on Asher Yatzar, and it could be that your grandparents never learned all of these laws, that this is just polemicizing. This whole thing is it bad that somebody wrote a book like that? I'm not convinced that it's bad, and I'm also not convinced that people who write doctorates on obscure topics is not necessarily bad. The question is not the writing of the book. The question is how seriously you're going to take the book. So, as I said, to say that at the end, one wonders whether our forefathers were ever really observant is just not a not. Accepted. And there are better universities and there are worse universities. And there are people that are looking and there are people that aren't. Again, there's a certain parallel that may not be a complete one. One of the Talmud's greatest contributions to Judaism and its indetermination, which means his understanding of Gemara is what Gemara tries to do is not determine law. So I'll read that one again. One of the Talmud's greatest contributions to Judaism is its indetermination. This is an absolutely... Okay, one second. Continue. Its frequent refusal to lay down the law. This is a misunderstanding of Gemara. Whoever wrote this sentence does not understand how to learn Gemara. Beginning, middle, and end. That's not what the Gemara is trying to do. Every now and again, the Gemara gives up and says, Teku, what can... Okay, that's that. We don't know how to answer that. Most people who've read the Gemara over the years will tell you that the Gemara does give you a conclusion. What that conclusion is, not everybody would agree what it was, but that the Gemara is deliberately trying to not determine the halacha, as I said, I cannot understand that sentence. Talmudic discussions consist primarily of competing positions, often lacking a clear decision which view is authoritative. I will say again, to the novice, it is very often that's the way the Gemara reads. To the person who is involved in understanding Gemara, then there are certain rules that one uses to understand what the conclusion of the Gemara was. The reason is obvious, which means he's turned this into an ideology. There should not be one. The purpose of the Gemara is not to give a conclusion. The well-known Talmudic statement, Eilu ve'eilu divrei lekim chayim, these and these were are the words of the God. These and those are the words of the living God, is the way he translated it, support this position. Halachic disagreement and radically opposing opinions are of the essence. There is a profound reason for this principle. The Torah, which is the word of God, can only be multifaceted, like God himself. It can never fit into a finalized system, for it is too broad in its scope. Now, so he just now introduced this concept of Eilav Eilav Divilkim Chayim. This is going to be his proof, as you see, that the halacha was never supposed to be determined. Excuse me? That's a very good question, but I'm not even going to go that far. If you want, and I've done this before, and I'm very happy to do it again, is to have a full discussion in depth on what does it mean, Eilav Eilav Divilkim Chayim. His claim over here, what the term means, how it fits within the larger Talmudic issue, his claim over here, and he's been building up to this, that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch are against Jewish tradition. They're very anti-Jewish because they determine law. The purpose of the Gemara is not to determine law. His proof for this is this phrase, Eilav Eilav Divilkim Chayim. Can we look at the first page for a moment of the sources? Because I couldn't help myself here. Let's read what the phrase says. Source number one. Omer Rabbi Abba Omer Shmuel. Shalosh Shonim Nechlaku Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. For 3 years, the schools of Hillel and school of Shammai argued. Halalu Omrim Halacha Kamoteinu, Halalu Omrim Halacha Kamoteinu. One said the law is according to us, the other says according to us. Which means, so far at least, Hillel and Shammai don't agree with him, because each of them think the law should be established, and each one of them think the law should be established according to them. What happens after 3 years? A voice comes out of heaven. What does the voice say? Yot Sabat Kol V'Amar Lahem, Eilu V'Eilu Divilikim Chayim Hin. Which means both these and these are the words of the living God. You know what the only problem is with his proof? That wasn't the end of the Bat Kol. The Bat Kol continues. It's still speaking. It says, the halacha kedivri Beit Hillel. And the law is like Beit Hillel. So if you can tell me how, you can bring a source to prove that the very concept of deciding law is antithetical to the Gemara, from a source that decides the halacha, is absolutely beyond me. And the only reason he was able to do it is because he very conveniently cut off the phrase in the very middle. You can't quote something by taking something out of context. You can't quote something by taking half a sentence. You can't quote something by taking it out of context. You can't quote something by cutting off half the sentence. What God said, according to this Gemara, in this Bat Kol, is these and these are the words of the living God, if that's what it really means, and I don't think that's what it means. But the halacha is like Beis Hillel, which means what is the Gemara trying to accomplish here? What did the Bat Kol accomplish over here? The Bat Kol is determining halacha, which is absolutely 100%, or if you'd like, 180 degrees diametrically opposed to what he was trying to prove from this particular Gemara. Moreover, as far as the tradition of the Gemara goes, the tradition of Torah Shebal Peh, is it really that the goal is not to determine halacha, or is the goal to determine halacha? Take a look at an interesting Gemara in the next source. Tanya, Amar Rabbi Yossi. Mitchila, originally, lo hayu marbim machloket b'Yisrael. Originally, there were not lots of arguments, or what this may mean is originally the arguments were not sustained. There was a high court of 71 that sat up by the Temple Mount. Why did this high court sit there? What's the reason? Why was there a high court? To settle disputes and to establish halacha. Is this based upon a minhag, a rabbinic law, or is this based upon Torah law? Absolute Torah law. Absolute Torah law. And what does Torah law say when there's confusion, when there's different opinions? What does it say? You're going to go to the court, you go to the Shoftim, and they're going to determine what halacha is. Does the Torah say in that case, the best thing to do is to leave things indeterminate and to leave different opinions alive? Is that what the Torah says? No. The Torah says, determine law. Let's continue to read this quote. ושני בתי דינים של 23, אחד יושב על פתח הר הבית ואחד יושב על פתח הזרה. There were two smaller courts which were in the same Temple Mount area. ושאר בתי דינים של 23 יושב בכל עירות ישראל. And there were other courts of 23 that sat in all the major cities in Israel. הוצרח הדבר לשאול, something came to be, a question came up, שאול מבית דין שבעירו. How would you start if you had a question? You'd go to the court in your city. Im shamru amr lehem, if they had a tradition, they told you the tradition. Im lav, if they don't have a tradition, barim lezeh shesamach le'iro, you go to the one which is adjacent to your city. Im shamu, if they had a tradition, amr lehem. Im lav, barim lezeh shel al petach harbayit. And so on. You keep going to the large, to the court, till you get, barim lezeh gazet, shesham yoshim, itamit shel shacha, itamit shel ben arbayim, uvishabatod, v'yom tovim, yoshim b'chayil, nishalash e'la b'fneim, a question to be asked. Im shamru amr lehem. If they knew that had a tradition, they would give an answer. Im lav amdim leminyan. If not, the high court was not allowed to leave something undetermined or indetermined. The high court has a halachic obligation to decide it, and they would stand to be counted. Rabu hamatme im timu. If the majority said it's tameh, it's tameh. Rabu mitarim tehiru. If the majority said it's tahor, it's tahor. Mishirabu tamide shamai vehillel. When the students of Hillel and Shammai were so numerous, v'shalosh shimshu kol tzarkan, and something happened here that they did not serve their masters properly, rabu machloket b'Yisrael, then we began to have lots of different opinion, but na'asitz tarah kishtei tarot, and became as if we had two different traditions. I want you to tell me something. The conclusion of this Gemara, which goes to talk about the students of Hillel and Shammai, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, which is what we started in the first source, does this Gemara make it sound like that's what the goal is? The goal is to get to these different opinions? Or does the Gemara sound over here like it's lamenting that the tradition or it doesn't work anymore? A matter of fact, the Rambam, when he quotes this Gemara, he says that as long as the high court functioned, then we would get rid of, we would solve all arguments. And that's the objective of the Judaism on a Torah perspective, that there should not be differences of opinion. What happened? The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. What happened? We no longer had a Sanhedrin. So what happens if you no longer have a Sanhedrin? Then you're going to have Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai each saying their opinion, and then each one's not going to back down. The Yerushalmi asks a very interesting question. It says, Heichon yotza bat kol? This bat kol that came out and said, Eilu ve'eilu, where did it come out? And you know what it answers? It says, in Yavne. So what's the significance of Yavne? Yavne is after the Churban of the Beit HaMikdash, which means Eilu ve'Eilu more becomes an approach after we no longer have what is the real approach, and the real approach is that we need to solve problems. And even that bat kol, what was the purpose of the bat kol? Was the purpose in order to tell us that halacha should never be determined, that we need to keep the two different opinions? Or was the purpose of that bat kol to say, the halacha kebeit Hillel? Since here we have people, for 3 years they couldn't determine. Why couldn't they determine it? Because they no longer had a Beit Din. If they had the proper Beit Din, they go to the Beit Din, they determine halacha. So in the absence of the Beit Din, so what does it then say? Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim Chayim. But the important part of that bat kol, was the next couple of words, the ones that got conveniently, or maybe unconveniently, edited out of the discussion, and that is v'halacha kebeit Hillel. So therefore, for using this as the basis of saying that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch did not understand Judaism authentically, because authentic Judaism, based on Eilu ve'Eilu, likes there to be arguments, all I can say is I don't know if this is a joke, or I don't know if this is complete naivete, I don't know if this is something which is deliberately wicked, and I don't know what to say about this. But is this a simplistic reading of the Gemara of Eilu ve'Eilu? Yes, this is a very simplistic reading of it. Is it, to use his terminology, an authentic reading of Eilu ve'Eilu? I do not believe it's an authentic reading of Eilu ve'Eilu. Does Eilu ve'Eilu does leave us with a wonderful feeling that when we have difference of opinions, both of them may have authority, or most of them may have validity to them? Because, by the way, I do not believe that the phrase Eilu ve'Eilu divrei Chaim should be translated as these and these are the words of the living God. I think the proper way to translate it is these and these are the living words of God. And the living words of God is very different than the words of the living God. The living words of God would mean that here we have a case that we don't know what tradition is, we don't know what we're supposed to do, which, by the way, is very clear from this other Gemara. It's when we don't know what to do. So if you use your mind and you use the principles and you're trying to figure out what the correct thing is. So you should know that both sides have legitimacy to them. That doesn't mean that both sides are right. It doesn't mean that both sides need to be embraced or necessarily accepted. Yes. Am I polemicizing now also? Am I... There's a real interesting technical issue, and that is, when we saw it clearly in this Gemara, although I didn't emphasize it enough, the Sanhedrin only has authority if it's sitting by the Temple Mount. It doesn't have authority as a Beit Din if it's not there. So once the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, there's no longer a functioning Sanhedrin. There could be some other kind of de facto court system or whatever, which we still have today, a de facto court system. It just doesn't have nearly the same authority. So I would assume if you had a functioning court, then as the Rambam says it, as he concludes in this Gemara, every argument that ever existed would be determined. Why? You have 71 people. And again, even if the 71 can't, if you have a break, then you keep adding two people. You keep adding two people, and you end up getting majority one way or the other. And the purpose of halacha, and again, this is not based upon a minhag. The purpose of halacha, from a Torah perspective, is in order to determine the halacha, in order to determine what the Torah wants of us. Marion, you're not going to argue with him again. I'm not going to let you talk anymore. Yeah. I said two things. First, what I said is it's one sentence, and let's not cut off part of it.
I heard you. In other words, possibly the first thing is leading into the conclusion at the end. Therefore, the end is what is the ikar. Except the beginning is also important in coming to the conclusion, so that has to be, according to the way I see it, taken into consideration very, very seriously. Even the way you translated it, which is, I love it and it's great. It's possible that in the times of Cardozo, they just, he was responding and reacting.
No, he's alive today. He wrote this 2 weeks ago.
Okay. It's possible that in his times, he lives in a Christian community.
Listen by it for God. At least he has for a long time, maybe.
Okay.
I know what he's doing. I understand what he's doing. I just don't think. I didn't say the first part isn't. I did say the first part isn't. But you can't say that. You can't say that the main teaching of Judaism is not to determine halacha. Let's continue a little bit. Yes, it's. I understand. Back on the bottom of page 4. In an illuminating discourse, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Maharshal, states, one should never be astonished by the range of debate and argumentation in matters of halacha. All these views are in the category of these and those are the words of living God. It is as if each one of them was directly received by Moshe at Sinai. The Kabbalists explain that the basis for this approach is that each individual soul was present at Sinai and received the Torah by means of 49 tzinarot, spiritual channels. Each one perceived the Torah from his own perspective in accordance with his intellectual capacity, as well as the nature and uniqueness of his particular soul. This accounts for the discrepancy in perception inasmuch and concluded that an object was tamei in the extreme, another perceived it as absolutely tahor, and a third individual argues the ambivalent status of the object in question. All these are true and authentic views. Thus, the sages declare that in a debate among the scholars, all positions articulated are different forms of the same truth. Marshall says this. I know which Kabbalistic sources he's quoting. It's very, very interesting. Now, so therefore, what's the conclusion? The Marshall writes this in his introduction to Baba Kama. Marshall's observation go to the heart of Judaism. There's no such thing as fixed Torah, which is identical for all. So now, it's interesting. This is his introduction to his book. The Marshal then writes a book which is a commentary on the Gemara. In his commentary to the Gemara, do you think the Maharshal will now ever determine halacha, or the Maharshal knows or Rabbi Cardoza writes that the main purpose is not to determine halacha because everything contains truth. So I had too much paper at home, so I decided to print out 291 occasions where the Maharshal decides the halacha. Now he decides the halacha, he reads through the Gemara in many of the cases and shows us this is the proper way of reading the Gemara to know that the Gemara, because the Gemara tells you what the halacha is, which means he does not seem to understand the conclusions that Rabbi Cardoza drew from him. If you want, anybody wants for homework to go through to all 291 occurrences where he does this, and some, there are three of them which are not accurate because it doesn't really give the conclusion, but if I would work harder, I would find much more. Let's just very quickly look back on page number one. Here is the Marshal, say, for Yamshel Shlomo. Without understanding anything going on in the case that he's giving over here, Bishum derav kahana v'rloza hikshol divrei rav v'shatik lo rav ha-ga'on ha-pasku karav v'chein dat rav alfis dezlinon l'chumra l'hachi lo iskir rif psak zev v'yafopi d'shatik lo rav harei rav av itme rav tirtsu yofa kushir rav kahana v'rloza gam vishnu rav loza ben yakov kavad naki v'locha kamoto v'kol malkom ayin adkan v'zil dat rach v'haramban. But this way, this does not sound like a man who's absolutely against determining halacha. He goes, we know how to determine halacha. How do you determine halacha? When a Gemara discusses something for a while, always look at the end discussion. The second discussion is the critical discussion, which means he not only does he think that you should be determining halacha, here he just gave you rules to determine halacha, and we can go on and on. Give one more source. And so on. And he goes into whole principles once again. How do you determine halacha? And in general, what happens when a Gemara brings a story and then argues on the story? Do you follow the story? Do you follow the thing? Which means, here's a man, as I said, I could bring hundreds of cases. What did he say in the introduction versus what was quoted? What did he say? That all the opinions which are found are opinions which have authority from God. That's a very nice thing to say. Did he then draw the conclusion and therefore every one of them is equally valid? No. Does he say, therefore we should not determine halacha? No. So quoting him over here was at least a little bit misleading. Let's look at the... We're not going to get through everything. I'm very upset. We'll do this another 3 weeks. Okay. So let's read a little more. It could even be argued that not all Jews were in need of the same mitzvot.
Where are you?
I'm on page 5. It could even be argued that not all Jews were in the need of the same mitzvot. It was only for the sake of comradeship and the common destiny of the Jewish people and their mission to the world that they all had to commit themselves to all of the mitzvot. In the words of Rabbi Mordechai Yosef from Izhbitz, or Izhbitza, and although not every Jew is in need of every prohibition in the Torah, he's still obligated to heed and suffer this prohibition for the sake of his fellow Jew. So now, he just now quoted in the middle of a discussion on halacha. He did admit he'll use non-halachic sources. But to quote the Meis Shiloach is a little unfortunate. And by the way, the other article I showed you also, the same Meis Shiloach, he wrote another Meis Shiloach, but it's the same idea that the main thing is to follow God and not mitzvot, because mitzvot really get in the way of God. The Meis Shiloach was a very interesting Kabbalistic, Hasidic leader. Just to show you how seriously I take the Meis Shiloach in halacha and in Jewish thought, here's my favorite Meis Shiloach, which I've taught you before. On page 2, number 5, he writes, "V'zeh mamash inyan Pinchas sheyadan et Zimri l'noaf ba'alma." Pinchas thought that Zimri was a no'ef. How do you say no'ef in English? An adulterer. By the way, was he an adulterer? Or was he guilty of some kind of sexual sin? Remember Zimri? Do you remember? So Pinchas thought he was. Alkein dano token on Pogimo. Therefore, he thought he had to kill him. V'nelami menu omik yisod adava shahoyi b'zimri. And he didn't know the deeper mystical idea that this, and he goes in this whole introduction that there's 10 levels of the Yetzirah. The first level of the Yetzirah is that you actively engage the Yetzirah. You actively go out to sin. The 10th level of the Yetzirah is you do everything in the world to stop it, and still somehow you sin. So then what do you know in that case? That it must be God's will. So he said that in Zimri, that Zimri sinned, so Zimri was really a very great tzaddik, and if Zimri sinned here, it must have really been the will of God. And he goes on to explain over here that Zimri was right and Pinchas was wrong. By the way, the Gemara uses that as a hypocrite. What's the definition of a hypocrite? Somebody who does this, does the actions of Zimri, but wants the rewards of Pinchas. The Gemara doesn't seem to know what the Meshiloach tells us, that it was really Zimri who did the right thing and Pinchas who did the wrong thing. It'll be very hard to find somebody who will consider themselves an Orthodox thinker to find something which is more twisted than this. And yet, the Meshiloach is the one that he quotes, that the only reason we even bother, that the real world is, there should be no halacha, and in the real world, everybody's soul should be connecting to God, which again, wonderful philosophical idea. And in the real world, I shouldn't have to do the mitzvah that you do, because my soul doesn't need your mitzvah. And in the real world, I should really know, by the way, based on this, what my soul needs. And if I try to stop myself, and the Yetzirah tells me to do it anyway, so that means that this sin is what my soul really needs. Again, I'm just taking the same person a little bit further. So again, how seriously I'm going to take the quote of the Meshiloach over here, you can decide for yourselves. Let's go back, continue on page 5. Halacha is the practical upshot of unfinalized beliefs, a practical way of life, or remaining in theological suspense. In matters of the spirit and the quest to find God, it is not possible to come to final conclusions. Still, it would be entirely wrong to believe that the need for practical application of halacha has anything to do with absolute truth. Rav Moshe Feinstein would disagree with him completely on this, and maybe we'll learn through Rav Moshe's introduction to his. He says that any time that a person is objective and a person is knowledgeable and you learn through a sugya and you come to a conclusion and you've gotten to what you believe to be truth, you're obligated to follow what your conclusion is. You're not allowed to follow somebody else's conclusion. And absolutely, the termination of halacha is connected to truth. But he says, no, it has nothing to do with practical halacha. It has nothing to do with absolute truth. While halacha is more stringent and unswerving, it must adhere to all the unequivocal truth that even opposing halachic opinions are all words of the living God, and each of them carries the potential to become practical halacha. So some of this is more serious than others. Rabbi Yosef Karo also states in his Rule Shulchan Aruch in general language without mentioning sources or other opinions. It's true that he first authored the Beit Yosef, in which he brings many opinions and citations, so one might argue that he did not want his Shulchan Aruch to become a distinct and self-contained work. One might argue this is actually what he writes in his introduction. He writes, we learned this earlier. He wrote, I wrote the Beit Yosef. I'm giving you all the discussions of the Gemara. I'm explaining to you how I got to my conclusions. And then he says, now I'm writing another book with just the bottom line conclusions to make it easier to study and to remember. But by all means, do not read my Shulchan Aruch without reading the Beit Yosef. So over here, again, it's just not true what he's writing. However, the fact is that once he authored this work, it quickly assumed this very status. It should be hard to argue that the author did not foresee this possibility. Maharshal accused the Rambam of acting as if he received the Mishnah Torah directly. So it's true that Maharshal, he goes against the Rambam for not bringing sources. Maharshal asked him, hey, they're right. He also went to Yosef Karo. All this is true, but Maharshal lived 500 years ago, and this is his many people that are going against the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, because they're... No doubt Maimonides and Rav Yosef Karo had the best of intentions, but again, and he says again at the end of this paragraph, it is set in motion an entire genre of halachic literature which is un-Jewish in spirit. Why is it un-Jewish? Again, because they go against the major principle of Judaism. What's the major principle of Judaism? Eilu ve'eilu divkim chayim. What about halachic beis hillel? That's not here. The question we need to ask is how to bring Judaism back to its original, authentic self in which the halachic tradition of eilu ve'eilu is once more recognized and applied. We must realize Judaism in an autonomous way of life. So now he goes into his suggestions, and his suggestions are that we make up a new halacha, we make up something new, and we'll call it halacha, that would it meaning, we'll go back to the Gemara, we'll find things that people connect to, and then we'll give them those things to do, because all of these things are multiple truths. Bottom line on page 6, the great halachic scholars of today and tomorrow will have to decide whether we are permitted to implement this idea, again, where he wants to just use anything which is mentioned in the Gemara as authoritative, even when they are rejected. Are they equipped with enough knowledge about our world, the moral spirit? Are they equipped? He's talking about the poskim, the moral, spiritual, religious crisis in which so many young people find themselves to handle this matter. Do they fully understand the central place that human autonomy occupies in today's society and in authentic Judaism? So part of that's true in contemporary society. And here's one which you'll like. Only question is what you do with it. Many of the rabbinic laws are fences for the distinct purpose of preventing people from violating Torah law. But what if they produce the opposite result? The absolute rejection of Torah law. Today, many of these rabbinic laws keep people out instead of inviting them in. They're not conducive to the spirituality longed for by all people trying to observe Torah laws. So here he wants to get rid of all or many rabbinic laws because rabbinic laws don't accomplish what they're supposed to accomplish. Undoubtedly, many rabbinic laws make it easier to observe Torah laws, but what if people feel confined by these laws which deny the spirit of, say, what prayer or Shabbat is all about? By the way, which rabbinic law goes against the spirit of Shabbat? Muktzah? Having your stores open on Shabbat? Which one? Which rabbinic law are we talking about? In many instances, it's not clear whether a law is deriva derabbanan and so on, but what he wants to do is get rid of derabbanan as well. Freedom in one area often leads to greater commitment in another. Minhagim, we should make up new minhagim, which again goes against the word minhag, what exactly minhag is. We need to, last paragraph on page 7, to avoid any misunderstanding, in no way am I suggesting that we do away with parts of Judaism or deny the divinity of the Torah or the importance of rabbinic law. The reverse is true. My observations, suggestions flow from a deep love and appreciation of what halacha is all about. It is out of love for the word of God which came down to us at Sinai this essay was born. What the leadership of Orthodox Judaism needs to realize above all is that the internal danger is greater than the external threat of secularism. Judaism must renew itself or face decline. The greatest problem Judaism faces is lack of belief in itself. Orthodox Judaism must stop being defensive and looking over its shoulder. It should strengthen itself by looking to its great Talmudic resources, rebuilding itself accordingly. Only when it reappears a dynamic living tradition averse to all finalization dogmatization will it become the great passion of all Jewish people. Many, many nice sound bites along the way. He writes and he speaks in sound bites. Right. The last paragraph here I actually gave you in total, he wants to do what's called harat sha'ah. There's a thing which is called, on a temporary level, a Navi, for example, come and say, don't keep Shabbos this week. A Navi cannot say, let's get rid of Shabbos. So what he wants to do is use harat sha'ah, but misuse it. And say, let's get rid of certain things, even though he admits along the way that he's misusing it. And then he gives examples how people did this over the last... I mean, look where it says such examples, around 10 lines from the bottom. Such examples can be found in Rav Shimshon Farel Hirsch, the concept of Torah of Derech Eretz. Rav Hirsch believed the Torah of Derech Eretz was Harad Sha'ah, you're going against Torah, or he believed that this is an authentic interpretation of Torah. The Chassam Sofer's opposition to general culture. Chassam Sofer did not think that this is Harad Sha'ah. He thought that the contemporary culture was bad. The Chatz Chaim's permission ruling about intensive Torah education for young women. It's true he uses the word eight lasot, but even there, it's not going against any Torah law, rabbinic law, it's not even going against halacha to teach Jewish women. But again, I can go into details of each thing that he brings along the way. The question, yeah. He thinks it's not authentic because they don't follow halacha, they don't believe the Torah is divine, which means he doesn't like conservative either because he doesn't think the Torah is divine. No, he claims that he is orthodox and he claims that he is authentic. But what I'm saying, when you read this essay, I upset you with this.
What would he say to a young man or a family of a young man that comes to him and says, my son doesn't want to be divided, he wants to
be... I can't tell you what he would say. All I can say is you should talk to him. What I would say is, first of all, say let's get rid of Dinei Drabanan because they put a fence around the Torah. On an individual basis, in individual cases, I can assure you that I and many other rabbis will tell people, do not follow this rabbinic law in this particular case. Because there's a particular reason. What's the difference? The difference is we don't go and publish it and say, therefore, we advocate everybody getting rid of this law. I had a case a number of years ago, a wonderful, wonderful young woman. and she was raised in a conservative family. She was the most sincere girl in the conservative movement. She put on tefillin every day, not as a feminist, because that's what she was told she's supposed to do. When she came to Israel, she came to Bar Ilan, and she understood that Orthodox people don't do this. Before she came, she realized, somebody explained it to her that this is not, because she wanted to become Orthodox. They said, Orthodox women don't do this. She gave her tefillin, which she had bought, I believe. She gave it to her brother, and she said, you need to put tefillin on every day. This is a mitzvah for you. You need to put it on every day. Anyway, I dealt with her parents a bit. Her parents are wonderful, wonderful people who happen to be committed conservative Jews, who raised their daughter in a wonderful way. She became Orthodox along the way, and when it came for Pesach, she went home for Pesach, and she said to me, my parents are making my whole house kosher for Pesach, according to my standards that I can eat there, but they drive to their conservative shul, which is a number of miles away. If I don't go with them to shul, I think they may take it as a slap in the face. What should I do? So I told her, tell your parents that you're going to come with her to shul, but ask them if they can get a non-Jewish cab driver to take them there and to take them back, rather than her father driving and getting the car with her father driving. If you want to understand details why I said this, I'll explain to you some other time, but that's what I told her to do. Now, would I therefore say all people should drive to shul and have non-Jewish cab drivers take them? No. In this particular case, I felt that this was the proper way to handle it. She approached her parents. You know what they said to her? They said, absolutely not. We know that you are observant. We do not want you to get into a car. We don't want you to get... But again, because they communicated. I saw her 2 weeks ago. And it was funny, because I told somebody this story an hour before I bumped into her. I bumped into her on Shabbos. She was pushing a stroller with her kids, wearing the shetel, with her mother walking next to her, walking on the way to shul. So again, rabbis will say there are cases. You know what? That's a drabbanan, don't do this. That's a man who don't do it. But we do it on individual cases, not to change the entire system. When you change the entire system, you end up getting yourself into trouble. He wants to revolutionize and change the entire system. Is he a sincere person? Absolutely. Does he mean well? Absolutely. By the way, the Meshiloach tells us that the reason that God rewarded Pinchas, even though he did a terrible thing, was because he was very sincere. And he was very sincere and meant well, so God rewarded Pinchas anyway. Oh, really? I would prefer... It is very dangerous. The reason I dealt with this is because I believe that this essay is a very dangerous essay. I believe that it's misguided. I believe it doesn't... There's many nice sound bites, but it does not have a leg to stand on in terms of Jewish approach. I think his writing against the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, was not justified. I think the language is much too strong. The language was much too strong, and there is an, again, I don't know if there's an arrogance in the individual, there's an arrogance in the writing by saying, I understand authentic Judaism, all these other people have not understood authentic Judaism, and his quote to support him was just an absolute misquote taken out of context, and the quote itself disproves what his position is, because it says, Eilu Eilu Dugum Chayim, the Halacha, Kibes Hilo. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Correct. Because if he was really pluralistic, then he should accept the Rambam as also an authentic expression of Judaism. Right. Absolutely. That was my first response when I read it. That was the first thing that I said. Okay, ladies.